You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Boilermakers Local 83 and Boyd Kenter Thomas & Parrish LLC. Boilermakers. They're sponsoring this show. They're a proud union, Local 83 from Kansas City, Missouri, where their office is, and representing workers in Iowa, Nebraska, and Kansas. And since 1983, our attorneys have aggressively represented the injured and have provided counseling to labor organizations throughout the area. We stand up for working families against those who would do harm, and that's Boyd Kenter Thomas & Parrish. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, have you seen the movie Black KK Klansman, about a black police officer who infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan 40 years ago? This week on the show, we're going to take a look under the hood, talk about the true story, and get reactions from viewers. Then, this year, over 1,000 workers in downtown Kansas City were suddenly laid off thanks to corporate restructuring at DST. Why is this happening? What impact will it have on the metro area? All that on tonight's show, but first the news. Leo Girard lambasts the Kavanaugh appointment, and federal union says support for a wage increase is growing on Capitol Hill. And then our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel. And now for the news.
News from our side, September 13, 2018. In a press release, the National Treasury Employees Union, which represents about 150,000 employees at 33 federal agencies and departments, said this week that there is a growing bipartisan consensus in Congress to reject Donald Trump's proposed pay freeze for federal workers and instead give the men and women of the civil service a modest raise in 2019. The House Democrats and Republicans from around the country and a flurry of public letters are calling for an increase of at least 1.9% for federal employees. The Senate has already approved a 1.9% adjustment. NTEU President Tony Reardon said, "All hearing directly from their constituents, thousands of whom are federal workers who simply want their paychecks to keep pace with inflation." He reported that support for federal pay raise is coming from both Democrats and Republicans. More than 100 members signed three letters explaining their support for the raise, including the need to recruit and retain skilled employees. Eight House Democrats wrote, "The American people want a federal government that keeps them safe and secure and reliably delivers vital services. The individuals of our federal workforce clock in each day on behalf of that mission." The Labor Department reported on Friday that wages for U.S. workers in the private sector grew 2.9% over the last year, and Congress has already approved a 2.6% bump for federal employees in the military. Under the Federal Employee Pay Comparability Act, federal employees should receive a 2.1% pay increase in January of 2019, but Trump doesn't want to give it to them.
Here's an edited opinion piece from USW President Leo Girard on the appointment of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's long, but since there's still a chance Congress could reject Kavanaugh, we think it's important to understand his thinking on worker protections. Girard wrote, "In his statement to Congress during his confirmation hearing, Judge Brett Kavanaugh said his mother taught him that judges must always stand in the shoes of others. Though hardly original or deeply inspirational, it's not bad advice. The problem is that Kavanaugh never chooses steel-toed work boots. In every case involving workers, Kavanaugh has put himself instead in the wingtips of the CEOs. He's a man born to wealth and privilege who attended Georgetown Preparatory, one of the most expensive private high schools in the country, with annual tuition of nearly $57,000, followed by a similarly exclusive Ivy League college education. The vast majority of Americans cannot conceive of paying $228,000 to get a kid through high school. Kavanaugh's opinions illustrate that he has no idea how to relate to them and, in fact, doesn't care to try to understand people with grit under their fingernails. That makes him, as a Supreme Court justice, dangerous to working people." The case that perfectly illustrates Kavanaugh's carelessness towards workers and obsequiousness towards corporations is SeaWorld versus U.S. Secretary of Labor Thomas Perez. Kavanaugh authored the dissent. Writing for the majority was Judge Judith W. Rogers, joined by Merrick Garland, Chief Circuit Court Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, and frustrated Supreme Court nominee by Obama, who the Republicans refused to confirm. Girard continues, "In this case, SeaWorld versus Perez, Garland figuratively pulled on water shoes of SeaWorld trainer Don Branchow, who was dismembered and drowned by six-ton killer whale named Tilikum, an orca that had killed humans twice before. Kavanaugh, by contrast, shoehorned himself into the fancy footwear of SeaWorld executives. After Tilikum killed 40-year-old Branchow before a horrified live audience at the SeaWorld Park in Orlando, Florida, in 2010, OSHA investigated. OSHA regulations require employers to provide a workplace that is free from recognized hazards that are causing or are likely to cause death or serious physical harm to its employees. Noting that Tilikum had killed people twice before, OSHA found that SeaWorld orcas had repeatedly endangered workers, including biting trainers, lunging at them, pulling them into the water, and, in a non-fatal incident in 2006, dragging a trainer by the foot and submerging him repeatedly for about 10 minutes. SeaWorld's own incident reports demonstrated that it knew of the threat to trainers, but just 2 months before Branchow's death, an orca in a Canary Islands SeaWorld killed a worker. Although SeaWorld claimed it didn't know working orcas were dangerous, OSHA determined that it had failed in its duty to provide a safe workplace by exposing trainers to hazards about which it was aware. OSHA fined SeaWorld $70,000 and recommended procedures to safeguard workers. SeaWorld appealed and lost, but Kavanaugh dissented, saying SeaWorld was like race car driving or football. It was a contact sport, and OSHA doesn't regulate contact sports. Actually, it does. Girard said, "That's absurd. An orca jumping show is not a sport, let alone a contact sport. No one in the SeaWorld audience is rooting for the home team." It's that Kavanaugh hates government regulation. In his dissent, he asked, When should we as a society paternalistically decide that the participants in these sport and entertainment activities must be protected from themselves? At the risk of significant physical injury is simply too great even for eager and willing participants. And, most importantly for this case, who decides that the risk to participants is too high? Government need not get involved, he contended, writing. The sports and entertainment industries regulate themselves, often through collaboration between management and participants, to ensure that the risks are at least known to all. Huh. We wonder if Kavanaugh has ever heard of Schlitterbahn and its famous water slide. Is that a contact sport? Gerard wonders if he's heard from the families of football players who, with dementia because of their contact sport. Gerard continues, certainly disagreeing with Kavanaugh are millions of workers whose employers deliberately expose them to hazards because it means making a quick buck. But Kavanaugh, who has worn nothing but white collars, wouldn't know anything about that. And he has made no effort to find out.
Emboldened by the Me Too movement, McDonald's workers have voted to stage a one-day strike next week at restaurants in Orlando and at nine other cities in hopes of pressuring management to take stronger steps against on-the-job sexual harassment. Organizers say it will be the first multi-state strike in the U.S. specifically targeting sexual harassment. Plans for the walkout to start at lunchtime on September 18th have been approved in recent days by women's committees formed by employees at dozens of McDonald's restaurants across the U.S. Lead organizers include several women who filed complaints with the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in May, alleging pervasive harassment at some of McDonald's franchise restaurants. Organizers said the strike would target multiple restaurants, but not every local McDonald's, in each of the 10 cities: Orlando, Chicago, Durham, North Carolina, Kansas City, Missouri, Los Angeles, Miami, Milwaukee, New Orleans, San Francisco, and St. Louis. In Kansas City, supporters of strikers will assemble at 63rd and Paseo on Tuesday at 11:30 a.m. The news tonight was read by Michael Savoie, Judy Ansel, and I'm Jen Zaman.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. You've just heard part of the soundtrack from the movie Black KK Klansman. The score is called Hatred at Its Best, composed by Terrence Blanchard. I'm Chris Mann.
I'm Michael Savoie. We're your co-hosts for this segment of Heartland Labor Forum.
Spike Lee has produced another thought-provoking film, Black KK Klansman. The legendary director of Do the Right Thing and Malcolm X has never been shy about expressing his political thoughts in his adaptation of Ron Stallworth's memoir, Black KK Klansman, gives Lee an opportunity to weigh in on the state of racism in America in the era of President Donald Trump. Working alongside a team of writers that includes his Chirac collaborator, Kevin Wilmont, Lee uses Stallworth's tale to take on a number of hot-button issues and topics, all the while telling the almost true story of the undercover events. Black KK Klansman is a well-crafted dramatization of real events, along with Hollywood additions.
John David Washington stars as the black KK Klansman as Ron Stallworth, a young man who becomes the first black police officer in the city of Colorado Springs, Colorado, when he joins the force in the late 70s. However, Ron's true ambition is to become a detective, which is why he agrees to go undercover and observe a speech by civil rights activist and black power proponent Kwame Ture, a.k.a. Stokely Carmichael. When the latter visits Colorado Springs, while there, Ron meets and befriends Patrice Dumas, a member of the Black Student Union at the city's local college. He is then assigned to the police department's intelligence section for his efforts.
Sometime later, while reading the city newspaper, Ron happens on an ad for people to join a local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan. Much to his fellow officers' surprise, Ron calls the KKK in response to the ad and thus sets in motion an ingenious scheme, one where he will converse with the Klan over the phone and his partner, Flip Zimmerman, who is played by Adam Driver, a white Jewish man, will pose as him when the Klan wants to meet him in person.
Ron's plan works so well that before long he even finds himself talking with David Duke, the infamous Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. But can Ron and Flip keep this charade going long enough for them to stop the Klan's plans to terrorize Colorado Springs with a literally explosive act of violence? Lee's film examines the sickening reality of what the Klan represents and makes it painfully clear how much these events from the past continue to resonate in the present.
So now we're going to switch to read some reviews of Black Klansman and give our own opinions about the film. First, we'll play an interview from Dennis from Kansas City, who was willing to be interviewed. I'm here with Dennis, who saw the Black Klansman film. Dennis, how did you like the film?
Well, I thought it was entertaining and exciting. And it was a story about infiltration, and there was a lot of danger and suspense in it.
So what do you think the central message was?
Well, to me it says that a fascist movement like the Klan can be defeated. They have a lot of faults, they have a lot of weak points, but I don't think it's going to be by the police in general. It won't be by the police.
So the film depicts a true story. What surprised you in the film?
Well, it is a true story, and Spike Lee took some pretty substantial liberties with the truth. What surprised me was how fortuitous and fortunate the outcome with the Klansmen being blown up and put in jail instead of their targets. So that was actually not entirely true. The bomb plot and that whole thing was substantially added in the film.
Would you recommend this film?
Yeah, I really would, but just for fun. You know, just for fun. It's very entertaining, and I enjoyed it, but here's the thing I have about it. You know, there's a boy-girl story that every Hollywood film seems to have. You know, it has to have. It's required. And I think Spike Lee kind of counterposes the outcome of the boy-girl story with the great confrontation between the Black Power movement and the Klan. He did counterpose. He shows at the end, you know, the organization of the Klan on one side of town and the organization of the Black Power movement on the other side of town. And he shows the dramatic contrast between the two. And that's good. I like that part of it. But the boy-girl story, which is also not true, I mean, it's not in the book, he counterposes that And his girlfriend, Ron's girlfriend, says, you know, are you still going to be a policeman? And he says, well, you know, I'm a black policeman, but I saved your life. And so he's going to go on being a policeman. But it's like what I said at the beginning, you know, the Klan can be defeated, but it's not in general. It's not going to be by the police.
So now we'll hear a couple of other comments. For example, Mr. O writes that Black Klansman is a searing, heart-wrenching reminder of how the toxicity of racism has plagued this country since the beginning. The last 5 minutes brought tears to my eye. Spike Lee doesn't mince words.
Okay. I had from Tyler T., funny, thrilling, and above all, interesting. Spike Lee pushes his cast towards greatness and fun in a poignant movie.
Chris G. says the movie was relevant, powerful, and well acted with a strong cast and a stellar soundtrack.
Okay, and Paula D. thoroughly enjoyed this movie. More of a documentary than a comedy, but filled with strong lessons and surprising ending that drove the message home to current events.
So with that, let's move into our opinions of the film ourselves. And we're happy to have Judy Ansel sitting in with us today, who also saw the movie. So,
hi, Chris and Michael.
Hi.
Hello, hello.
So who wants to go first and share their opinion?
Well, I maybe should go first since it seems that my opinion may be counter to the grain here. I found very little true about the movie other than the name of the first black officer in Colorado Springs. The movie certainly concealed the fact that he was a part of the FBI's counterintelligence program. During that era, and he spent 3 years infiltrating black radical movements in that area. Very little evidence that he did anything more than that. He certainly, I wouldn't say he infiltrated the Klan because he only talked to them on the phone, but nonetheless, the movie was said to be based on a true story. It was comedy and drama, which is kind of a hard mix. Comedy kind of takes away from drama. And all in all, Spike received a pretty high critic review. And I was kind of surprised at that because I've in the past kind of thought him as a darling of the film critics, and this kind of proves that wholeheartedly. Judy, what's your opinion?
Well, you know, when I walked out of the theater, I thought a few things. First off, I think it's really well crafted, and that's probably why it got such good reviews. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's dramatic. It kept me on the edge of my seat, mm-hmm. you know, and I could identify with the characters, mm-hmm. and I you know, just a couple of things. I thought it was really interesting that a major theme of the movie was the anti-Semitism of the Klan, and mm-hmm. you know, I knew the Klan was and always has been very anti-Semitic. But there were Holocaust deniers in there, and, you know, as late as the 1970s, this was a big issue. I think it portrays but doesn't probably give credit enough to the police officer, who, by the way, wasn't Jewish, I guess, in reality.
He was not.
Who went in there, the white officer, who went in there and really took the risks. But he's kind of the secondary character in this, mm-hmm. which is fine, you know. But, you know, at the end of the movie, they show us footage from Charlottesville of last year and the demonstrations. I'd never seen that footage, and it pretty much blew me away because it was super violent. I mean, people just really, really, you know, walloping each other. And, you know, it was something, but I didn't really think it belonged there. I thought it was overkill to have that footage there. But then I thought about it, and I thought, okay, so how do we get from the 1970s, Colorado Springs, this incident, to Charlottesville? And what happened to make so little progress? And then when you told me, Michael, about the fact that, in fact, this was part of a COINTELPRO operation where the police were actually infiltrating the black radicals, the black power people. And then I thought about, oh yeah, COINTELPRO really did a great job of wiping out what had the civil rights movement had become. You know, became the black power movement, the Black Panther Party, but the real movement to end racism in our society, and it got wiped out by COINTELPRO. Absolutely. And that's why we have Charlottesville.
Absolutely.
You know, now the movie doesn't tell me that, but it certainly made me think about that.
Connected dots, certainly. You know, I had a personal experience. Of course, I was probably a 21 or 22 year old. It just recently left home and was at home on Sunday, my mother's home, and door was knocked. A couple of FBI agents want to interview my brother, who was a 19-year-old, who was the chairman of the Black Student Union at UMKC.
And I bet he was really outraged. Dangerous.
Oh, yeah, he was really a dangerous guy, okay? And so that was the nature of the overkill that the FBI brought in this counterintelligence program that, like you said, Judy, literally eviscerated the Black Power movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I too saw the movie, and it is a lengthy movie, and I did not fall asleep, so I consider that a good movie.
You mean you fall asleep during all bad movies?
Many.
Okay.
Yes,
that's your test.
So I felt that the film really drew out how racism is destructive. I just felt that, and even to show the deep hatred from the Klansmen, I thought that was an accomplishment of the movie, and that the hatred covers up any meaningful life for people that fall into the trap of being racist. So,
can I add one thing, Chris?
Sure.
I thought the role of the wife who was going to plant the bomb, of the wife of the Klansman, was just really interesting because, you know, like, they didn't care a bit what she thought. They didn't develop her. She was just there to get the coffee and feed those guys. I mean, the whole situation was just really sexist and, mm-hmm. you know, not an exaggeration of how a lot of women were treated during that period and probably still today, you know. But she then becomes the vehicle to plant the bomb, you know. And I just thought that was an interesting aspect of the movie, mm-hmm. to show, you know, her role, and, you know, and to show that these guys aren't only a racist and anti-Semitic, but they're also super sexist. You know, I mean, this is truly white male supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hey, we've only got 3 minutes. We better move to wrap it up. I wanted to comment about, as I said earlier, Spike has been the darling of the critics, but I found an interesting critique by Boots Riley, film director of Sorry to Bother You. And Riley writes that for Lee to come out with a movie where the story points to a fabricated, where the story parts are fabricated in order to make a black cop and his allies look like they're involved in a fight against racism is really disappointing. Riley also said the movie is trying to make the counterintel operative look like a hero. And those were just a couple of the comments that I thought were right in time, but nobody else saw that. Mm-hmm. Mm. Do we want to move on with the 2-minute warning here? Since our time is running out, the film does show live footage of the Charlottesville incident, but I thought it was quite appropriate. And I think it's appropriate for no other reason than it seeks to educate around the origins of hate. And the more we can spread that message, the more that we can realize it's not a black problem, it's an American problem. You know, the better it can be addressed, and the more likely we are to be free of this sort of bigotry and hatred that's so permeated our society and most recently has been stirred up by the political environment that it exists in. So If we still got a moment, I would also comment, quote from the National Review, that Lee has turned a pro-cop film, can't read my own writing, to be counted as one of the stranger cultural developments of 2018. In other words, he's saying that, my goodness, this coming from Spike Lee seems kind of odd.
That's from the National Review?
Yeah, National Review.
That's a right-wing magazine.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I want to end here, I think, with a quote by the real Ron Stallworth. He says, "Let me put it this way. It hasn't changed," he told NPR. "To me, race is the single most divisive factor affecting American society. It's an issue we're afraid of." And quite frankly, he was surprised that the issue is still as strong as it was. So thank you for listening, and stay tuned for part two of the Heartland Labor Forum.
Most times, KKFI moves against the stream, but just saying, "Play KKFI to your smart speaker," will bring our stream to you, KKFI, wherever you are.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
This is about how we integrate the system. This is full spectrum sustainability, which just means that what we do in one area supports and reinforces the larger context in which we work.
As we face the long climate emergency, pathfinders are transforming our ways of living and bringing resilience from the ground up into widespread practice. On The Bioneers.
Friday morning at 9:30, right after Between the Lines.
Our listeners love to support organizations that support KKFI. To reach a diverse and active community, become a community marketing partner. Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. This is Jacob White. Joining me in the studio is David Hudnall, the editor-in-chief of The Pitch KC. Welcome to KKFI Studios.
Thanks for having me, Jacob.
Yeah. So we're here to talk about your August 25th feature, The Gutting of DST Systems, and what it means for Kansas City. So I thought maybe we could just start by talking a little bit about what DST is, or, you know, I'm not even sure if that acronym means anything. So
yeah, I think I've forgotten what it stood for originally, but yeah, just kind of a background of the company.
Yeah.
So it was founded as part of a division inside Kansas City Southern, which is an old train, sort of a legendary Kansas City company, a railroad company. And basically they just monitored trains going back and forth. They used some kind of, you know, 1960s, 70s technology for that. And eventually over the years they refined that and started using it to process mutual fund transactions and financial processing. So they basically do the back end for financial firms, a variety like Invesco or MassMutual or some of these places. So if you have money in these accounts and you move it around, they're the ones on the back end who process that. And they've kind of diversified over the years into healthcare and a few other areas, but that's basically what they do. A pretty boring company, I would say.
Yeah.
But a huge company also. So
very staid is
right.
The word that
very Midwestern, I think, is how I described it in my story.
They also... You mentioned that they have you describe it as an immeasurably immense impact on downtown as a neighborhood, bucking the grain, going against the grain on their approach to downtown. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think as DST was coming up, downtown was going down in terms of the people and businesses down there, and this is like the, you know, late 70s, 80s, 90s. And instead of kind of fleeing to the suburbs, DST made it a real point to invest and buy up these buildings, invest in them, and kind of try and stay put and keep Kansas City's downtown alive, I guess. And so that's kind of throughout its entire existence, I think it's been a core of that company. Is like, we're a downtown Kansas City company. We're invested in this place, and we want to make it a more lively, important, culturally vibrant place. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think
in success, kind of, you know. So,
yeah, one of the things that you highlighted was the land for the Power and Light area. How they
cobbled that together. But so there was a bunch of disparate properties and parcels downtown when they wanted to build that. And I think that was a problem, is that they wanted this kind of bigger vision for downtown, but like there were all these kind of absentee landlords and kind of blighted structures, and they kind of went in and bought up all of that stuff and then kind of sold it to the city for cost and said, let's do this major project here now.
And it really sort of highlights a difference between DST as sort of a local company and some of the major players in the downtown market today. One thing that sort of came to mind was, you talk about how they played a role in transforming the central library building downtown.
Yeah,
from Bank of America.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of a crumbling old Bank of America building, and they, along with other people, I mean, I talked to Crosby Kemper for the story, and he was, you know, I think one of the, maybe Crosby's brother, another Kemper, was really involved in that. But there was sort of this recognition that, you know, this building could be a kind of hub, like a cultural hub, in the middle of downtown, like an institutional kind of reinvigorating presence. And again, I mean, I think that's borne out. I think that's pretty much the case down there today. So,
yeah, and I don't know if it was directly related, but you mentioned how they would take like 30% of the TIF money that they, you know, got and sort of redistributed to other organizations that they thought were doing good work downtown or other things to uplift the community. And it just, it really seems like it sort of hits one of the big themes of your article, which is like, now, you know, we have a levy, a possible tax levy for the library that we're going to vote for. And, I work in libraries, I support libraries a lot, but you have to wonder if it wasn't for all the abatements downtown, if they would need to be raising all this extra money.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of working on a story about that at the moment, but yeah, I mean, I think that's, I mean, I think even you could talk to, you know, the people at the library and they would say the same thing. It's like, these tax abatements, it's tough because I think back when DST was doing them, you're seeing them used to truly correct blight, right? And now these tax abatements are to just give a luxury hotel some extra cash so they'll build their thing here, even though we don't really need that. And that's coming at the cost of libraries and schools, the tax revenues that libraries and schools should be getting.
Yeah, and the slack has to get sort of picked up by everyone.
Yeah,
else.
Because so then it's just you and me who are stuck with the tab, and I think that's why people hate this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was sort of surprised when the levy for the Mid-Continent Library passed, because that was also really like right on the heels of giving Cerner a lot of money through a tax abatement, but people didn't really seem to mind. Which is good because people valued the library, but yeah. So I think we're in agreement that it's sort of a different mentality now.
Yeah, and I think that we're reaching a tipping point where, or I think that people are more, because TIF is kind of it's a complex thing. I mean, it's not really that complex when you get down to it, but it's kind of challenging to understand. But basically, people are sort of starting to understand the gist, which is that it's basically taking public money and giving it to private developers, many of whom do not need that money. And I'm outraged about it. Yeah, I think people are starting to be too. So I think those types of it, and especially as inequality just becomes more insane in this country, I think that, you know, people are just going to start saying like, well, why are we giving this money to these already rich people?
Yeah.
So
yeah, I mean, we're getting a little off topic.
I could talk about this all day.
Yeah, the Lowe's hotel also just seems really ridiculous to me, but you could talk about any number of things. The main point for this part of the conversation that I wanted to get across though is that the DST, before, when they were like a local company, they did a lot for downtown.
I think that they were using TIFF at a time where downtown truly was blighted, and they were making a real difference. And more to the point, they were a local company that was invested in it. Like, you know, so we mentioned before, like, yeah, they gave 30% of some of those TIFF revenues to businesses. You know, that's a generous thing, but it's also a smart business move, because it's like, well, you know, if there's a nice coffee shop and lunch place next door to our offices, people will want to work for us more. You know, it'll be a night, you know, and everything. It's like the boat lifts, right? Or is it the water lifts? I can't remember. But so, yeah, I mean, I think that was kind of a different time. And now when you see, you know, your Cordish's or whatever, that's not a company that's based here. They don't have a lot of incentive to think about their neighbors. They want that TIFF money. They want to throw it in the books, and that's it. So,
yeah. Or if you complain about it, they say, well, the banks, you know, we can't get the loans unless we get the TIFF money,
right?
Whatever. Yeah, just keep on pushing the blame further down. But
it's an incredibly hollow argument. But yeah,
yeah. The other part of the article that I wanted to talk about, though, was the I mean, you really describe it, and I think it's fair to say, but as economic violence against the workers at DST, what's happened to them. I know it's just a big story, but maybe just starting with how the layoffs got started, and then the total, you know, lack of response from DST to help people after they got laid off.
Yeah, so there, I mean, there's a lot there, I guess, but so basically I think that things started to change at DST when the founder, Tom McDonald, who had been there since the late 60s, announced he was stepping down. I think he announced he was stepping down in 2009 and stuck around until 2012. And I think, like, in 2009-10, they started to have their first, like, rounds of massive layoffs, which I think that was the Great Recession. I think that was – I think everybody was kind of doing that, you know. So, but then when his successor, Steve Hooley, took over, that is when you know, I talked to probably 30 people for this story or workers and various – people, and they basically said there was a very dramatic shift after McDonald left, which was, you know, now we are a company that we only care about the stock price. We are trying to achieve every efficiency possible. People are doing three jobs, you know, so there'd be a round of layoffs, and then afterwards it's just one person is doing the job that three people used to do. Their health benefits are getting scaled back. I think they used to have total health benefits, and then all of a sudden now they're paying for worse benefits. And so just a variety of kind of things that erode the, you know, a culture that this guy built, this guy and the other leaders of the company built over a long period of time. And then I think you start to see, you know, you're not seeing those generous TIFF grants, you know, in these kind of civic virtue and charitable giving. And so, yeah, I mean, I can kind of keep going. I'm trying to.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I guess just going back to sort of the way that Hooley ran the company, I think that some of the things sort of reminded me of some of the complaints that you might hear from, well, from anyone, from Bernie people or from Trump people about, you know, outsourcing.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's interesting about this story maybe is that I think the outsourcing story we hear a lot is, or the offshoring or whatever you want to, like, is they shut down a steel plant and send the jobs to China or Mexico or whatever, right? This is a little, and you know, so it's, those stories are usually about, yeah, steel workers, pipe fitters, whatever. This one is more about the gutting of, like, this kind of IT company, this huge IT company. It's more white collar. It's more like, you know, the people who are being squeezed are, you know, people with master's degrees and stuff like that. So not that makes it any more important, but I think it does shine a light. I think maybe you could read the story and be like, oh yeah, like this is coming for all of us on this path, right. Unless there are some sort of dramatic changes, maybe, because, you know, in a way, guys who run, you know, public companies like that, they can be sued by their shareholders for not maximizing every efficiency. You know, that it's they kind of have to do that. Like, they maybe didn't have to do it in kind of like the most callous way that I think the DST did it. But basically, once you're a public company, your obligation is to your shareholders, and all your shareholders care about is the stock price. And so I find that to be a really messed up system, because it cannot take into account human lives. And so I don't know, I guess I'm starting to sound like a crazy person, like a socialist, but like, you know, so
most of what our show is.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm in the right place, but yeah. I mean, that's just kind of the deal. And I think, you know, that's kind of obvious to people, but I think, you know, I wanted to do this story because I felt like I had the access, I had done the reporting, and I felt like I could sort of make it clear in a new way, I guess. So,
yeah, we're talking with David Hudnall about the gutting of DST systems and what it means for Kansas City. Back to sort of what it means for Kansas City. So when I was looking at some other stories about DST, one of the articles I came across was in the Wall Street Journal. I don't have it up right now, but it was talking about how Kansas City is having a hard time like retaining college-educated people, and the Denver and Austin, for various reasons, which we can speculate on, have been growing. More millennials, people under 35, under 40, are moving there, and not as much to Kansas City. So when 1,000 or so white-collar workers get laid off, the city sort of has a crisis as far as, like, are they going to stay? So how did that part play out?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. There are organizations in the city that are supposed to do, or whose mission is to do, like, workforce training and get people, you know, set up in new jobs and get people who are laid off in these situations to new places. And so, of course, DST lays off 1,000 people in a day, gives no warning to the state or the city, to any of these organizations who can actually help these people get back on their feet. Meanwhile, it's giving, this was just, I thought, a nice detail in the piece was, you know, I was looking through the SEC filings and looking at the compensation that some of these executives got, and one of them was that, like, I think the chief operating officer or somebody, chief financial officer, received like a $30,000 stipend for workforce training. So that he gets $30,000 to, a guy who's already a millionaire gets $30,000 just to like help find himself a new job, even though he just engineered the sale of this, or was part of engineering the sale, or was an executive while the sale was engineered. Right. Meanwhile, they can't, the company itself can't be bothered to even tell a single government official or agency that there's about to be 1,000 people out on the street.
Yeah. And it's,
and by the way, you hear nothing from the mayor or anybody in the council about any of this stuff. They just pretend like it's not happening.
They just want to talk about the scooters.
Right. And like what you're saying about, Denver and Austin, you know, they, of course, that's everybody's dream here, right? Everybody in government's dream here is that we would be like these cities, but we're clearly not. And yet all we hear about is, you know, how we're the city of creatives, millennials on the move. Right. And yet, meanwhile, this company just laid off 1,000 workers. You know, there's just nobody wants to talk about it because they'd rather cheerlead about this stuff. It's insane.
Yeah. And one thing that just sort of strikes me now is like, you know, regardless of where these people live, Kansas City has a 1% income tax. And so losing 1,000 pretty well paid workers
is
a big slash into the city itself.
Yes, know? For sure.
Regardless of how you feel about flat taxes, which I'm not a big fan of, but you know, I mean, how much were the DST people? They were like, these were pretty good jobs.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think there were better jobs 10 years ago, and I think they probably flatlined. And you would talk to people who would say, like, we've gotten a 1% raise over the last, like, 6 years, something like that, not even keeping up with cost of living and inflation and stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think these are people, these are not people making $28,000 a year. I think this is 40 to 90 to, you know, that kind of area. Maybe some of the people who've been there longer, over 100.
Yeah.
And of course, the CEO making $7 million. And right. So.
Well, we've been talking to David Hudnall. The story is the gutting of DST Systems and what it means for Kansas City. He's the editor-in-chief of The Pitch KC. Thanks a lot for coming into the studio today.
Thanks, Jacob.
All right, everyone, have a good night.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Good evening, and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel. Tonight, I want to speak to you a bit about the history of Labor Day. Labor Day is observed on the first Monday in September, and it was established to honor the workers who fought and still fight for our rights in the workplace and beyond. Labor Day was officially made a federal holiday in 1894, after 30 individual states had already officially began celebrating it. How Labor Day came to be an observed holiday in the United States is an interesting and complex story. During the major economic depression of the early 1890s, the Pullman Palace Car Company cut wages in its factories. Discontented workers joined the American Railway Union, led by Eugene V. Debs, which supported their strike by launching a boycott of all Pullman cars on all railroads. ARU members across the nation refused to switch Pullman cars onto trains. When these switchmen were disciplined, the entire ARU struck the railroads on June 26, 1894. Within 4 days, 125,000 workers on 29 railroads had quit work rather than handle Pullman cars. The strike was broken up by the United States Marshals and some 2,000 United States Army troops sent in by President Grover Cleveland on the premise that the strike interfered with the delivery of the U.S. mail. During the strike, 13 workers were killed and 57 were wounded. Workers across the country had taken part in the struggle, and no doubt from Washington, D.C., the Pullman strike looked like one step down from political insurrection and revolution. President Grover Cleveland put reconciliation with the labor movement as a top political priority, and Labor Day became a federal holiday. Politically, it seemed that he had little choice. The funny thing is, the workers had already chosen their own holiday a decade before, and it was already being celebrated internationally. In the late 19th century, the working class was in constant struggle to gain the 8-hour workday. Working conditions were severe, and it was quite common to work 10 to 16-hour days in unsafe conditions. Death and injury were commonplace at many workplaces and inspired such books as Upton Sinclair's The Jungle and Jack London's The Iron Heel. As early as the 1860s, working people agitated to shorten the workday without a cut in pay, but it wasn't until the late 1880s that organized labor was able to garner enough strength to declare the 8-hour workday. This proclamation was without the consent of employers, yet demanded by many of the working class. Ideology was a huge factor in working class struggle at that time. At this time, socialism was a new and attractive idea to working people, many of whom were drawn to its ideology of working class control over the production and distribution of all goods and services. Workers had seen firsthand that capitalism benefited only their bosses, trading workers' lives for profits. Thousands of men, women, and children were dying needlessly every year in the workplace, with life expectancy as low as their early 20s in some industries, and little hope but death of rising out of their destitution. To many workers, socialism offered another option, and it was popularly discussed among labor unionists and other social justice activists of that time. At its national convention in Chicago, held in 1884, the Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions, which later became known as the AFL, proclaimed that 8 hours shall constitute a legal day's labor from and after May 1, 1886. On May 1, 1886, more than 300,000 workers and 13,000 businesses across the United States walked off their jobs in the first May Day celebration in history. More and more workers continued to walk off their jobs until the numbers swelled to nearly 100,000, yet peace prevailed. It was not until 2 days later, May 3, 1886, that violence broke out at the McCormick Reaper Works between police and strikers. At that time, police opened fire and killed a few workers. The people of Chicago responded by calling a meeting in the Haymarket Square in response. Despite even the mayor being in attendance as a speaker, a never-identified person threw a bomb in the crowd and the police opened fire. Several people were killed. In the sham trial which followed, many of the leaders of the Chicago labor movement at the time were tried as responsible for the deaths and were executed. People across the country and world adopted May 1st as International Labor Day, and they continue to observe it to this day. Why do we not observe May Day in the United States as a holiday that was born here? The history of May Day, Labor Day, and the working class is too rich and complicated to truly share in a 5-minute show. I strongly encourage everyone to read about the subject themselves. This story adapted from Union Plus and IWW.org. Solidarity, fellow workers.
And now for the calendar. And now that you know what May Day was, maybe you'll celebrate it, huh? We'll be sure to remind you just before May 1st in 2019. So, third Saturday, Wyandotte Democratic Breakfast. This Saturday, September 15th, 8:15 for breakfast, 9 o'clock for speakers. This is at Las Islas Maria, 7516 State Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas. And the speakers for this month are State Senator Lynn Rogers, who is the Democratic candidate for Kansas Lieutenant Governor, and Nathaniel McLaughlin, Democratic candidate for Kansas Insurance Commissioner. Both of them will be speaking. For free legal advice, if you are a victim of wage theft, and many people are, Monday, September 17th, the Wage Theft Clinic from 5 to 8 p.m., sponsored by the Kansas City Worker Justice Center, and this is to be held at 650 Minnesota Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas, 66101. Tuesday, September 18th, Me Too McDonald's March Against Sexual Harassment. We covered this in the news. There is going to be a march from 63rd and Paseo to, guess what, a McDonald's. Everybody's to gather at 11:30 a.m., and this will last until 1 p.m. So come to that one. Trauma and Immigration, Explore the Impact and the Science. This is Tuesday, also September 18th, from 6 to 9 p.m., at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. And you need to make a reservation, and the easiest way to find it is to go to our webpage, heartlandlaborforum.org, find the calendar, and click on the link. But if you don't do that, then you can go to Facebook and look up the website of Jewish Vocational Services, and you should be able to find the event. Stop Hating the Criminals. Start Hating the System that Produces Criminals. This is a conference, Saturday, September 29th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Robert J. Mohart Multipurpose Center, 3200 Wayne in Kansas City, Missouri. This is sponsored by Missouri Cure, that's Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants, and by Representative Brandon Ellington. You can find our calendar, our upcoming shows, and our archived shows on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is going to be called, is going to be about Proposition A on the August ballot, how we defeated right to work, and now what. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zeman. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved.
Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI. Where you come from to struggle.